This is a marketing communication. Please refer to the Key Information Document, or KID, before making any final investment decisions. Investing involves risk. The value of an investment and the income from it may fall as well as rise, and investors might not get back the full amount invested. Past performance does not predict future returns. The mention of any particular security or strategy should not be considered as a recommendation. For further information on the Brunner Trust, please go to www.brunner.co.uk.
Everyone's focusing on demand. Everyone's focusing on demand growth and they're ignoring supply. And, you know, as we know from these previous cycles, it's supply that's as equally important as demand.
But this new technology really changed everything. It changed the game and led to a really big increase in capacity.
Hello and welcome to Connected Investor from the Brunner Investment Trust. I'm Julian Bishop.
And I'm James Ashworth.
Now, we often hear that history doesn't repeat, but that it rhymes. So in this episode, we wanted to look back at some past investment cycles and see if there are any general lessons that could be applied to today's AI investment boom.
We've picked a few fairly recent examples where a hot industry drew in lots of investment, which ultimately brought the party to an end.
So that's a good place to start. Is there a common pattern to the examples we'll discuss today?
Yes, there is. The examples we'll talk about today are all ones with commodity products, where those products by definition are undifferentiated.
Yep.
And where it's possible for new entrants to enter the market, or where it's possible for the existing players in the market to increase supply. So if you think back to your GCSE or A-level economics, these are pure sort of commodity markets. What happens in those markets is that the amount of supply in the market responds to the level of prices and the level of profitability. And we see what is called a capital cycle. So if there is a disturbance, let's say an exogenous shock that leads to an increase in price levels, you know, an increase in prices tends to lead to an increase in profitability for the people who are present in that industry. Yep. And that level of elevated profitability draws in new firms or increases capacity from the existing firms in the market. That increase in supply in turn leads to a decline in prices and a decline in profitability, and ultimately some capacity will look to exit the market. And so we end up with a cycle, high prices drawing capacity, which results in low prices, which leads to capacity to exit in a sort of perfect circle, if you like.
Yeah, so I mean, think you mentioned GCSE economics. I did A-level economics.
Very impressive.
And this is really the fundamental, foundation of capitalism, isn't it? Just supply and demand. High prices attract competition.
Exactly.
They attract new supply.
Yeah.
And if you look back at economic history, there's just numerous examples of cycles that follow this common pattern. So I think one good one to start off with is iron ore. So let's talk about the mining super cycle that occurred at the beginning of the last decade.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a really interesting one. So iron ore, obviously a commodity product, a key input into manufacturing steel. And for decades, this had been a very sleepy commodity. I guess the commodity price of iron ore before about 2005 had always been about $25 a ton, give or take. But something really changed at that point. Maybe a little bit of a history lesson. What happened to the iron ore price, and what was the driver of that change?
So really, one word, China. So the industrialization of China consumed a vast amount of steel. And this really took off again. It went up another leg following the financial crisis. So if you think about the financial crisis, 2008, 2009, China's main export markets were in recession. China, in response, stimulated its economy with this huge program of property building, infrastructure build-out, airports, bridges, railways, etc. And of course, all this consumes vast amounts of steel, which is ultimately made from iron ore.
So this huge increase in demand for iron ore leads to an enormous increase in price. Right? There's a huge increase in demand that drives prices up.
Yep.
And we see the iron ore price increase from what had always been roughly $25 a ton to a peak of around $200 a ton. Presumably, that's wonderful for the iron ore companies, the iron ore miners. Maybe talk us through how they respond to this environment, this huge increase in prices and presumably profitability.
So you're right. They're making huge amounts of money at these prices. And these supernormal profits attract new supply. Now, most of the world's best iron ore resources are in Western Australia. So if you think Northwest Australia, there's a region called the Pilbara, where the ground is made out of iron ore effectively. Very, very high grade, requires minimal processing. And at that point, because of these very, very high profits, pretty much every iron ore producer in the world looked to increase capacity. So if we look at one of the biggest, Rio Tinto, London-listed company, they expanded their system in Northwest Australia in this area called the Pilbara from, look at my notes, from about 220 million tonnes a year to about 290 million tonnes per year within just a few years. So their capital expenditures, this is the amount they have to spend on mines, the railways to get it to port, they actually built their own port as well, went from about $5 billion in 2009 to about $17 billion in 2012. So it tripled in just 3 years. And what does this mean, of course?
A huge increase in supply naturally sows it's the seeds of the end of the cycle. And
exactly.
I guess we see a decline in price. And as you say, that increase in investment was replicated across the industry. There was a good chart from Rio Tinto actually at one of their capital markets days that pointed out that while the whole industry had invested less than $15 billion a year in 2010, by 2012, that had roughly tripled to more than $40 billion. So industry-wide, huge increase in supply naturally leads to a decline in prices. And I think we've got a chart of the iron ore price, and I think the iron ore price, you know, collapses from that peak of more than $200 a ton to something much more sensible, much more like, again, I try to find my chart and my notes.
I think it fell to about $50. Yeah, I think
exactly.
I think the history is you went from 25 to 150, at the very peak 200. And then a few years later, once all this new supply came on, the price fell back to $50.
Yes.
And I think the lesson here is that people tend to look in investment and in economics, they look at demand, but they forget supply. And in markets without barriers to entry, supply is equally important to the economic equation as demand. And with this, of course, you know, Rio itself sowed the seeds of its own destruction. So I think at the peak of Rio's profitability in 2011, they earned operating profits of around $20 billion, but that fell back to $6 billion in 2015. So their response, of course, is then to cut that CapEx. They cut what they're spending. They don't look to add new supply. And their CapEx themselves went from about $17 billion in 2012 to just $5 billion a few years later.
Yeah. And again, that tightness of capacity investment was replicated across the industry. And that same chart from Rio Tinto shows that at an industry level, total investment dropped, I think, below $10 billion by 2017 or so. So we see that, you know, the low prices lead to a drop in investment and capacity effectively exiting the industry.
And with time, demand catches up and prices recover. And this is just a story that repeats itself throughout economic history.
So maybe that's a good time to move on to any other examples we've got here. I think, the oil price boom and shale oil is another good example of a commodity product where a high level of prices, good level of profitability, draws in new capacity, which itself leads to, a collapse in prices. So maybe we should talk a little bit about the backdrop here, the oil price coming out of the financial crisis was around $100 a barrel. Maybe talk us through what was driving demand for oil at that point. And then we can talk a little bit about what might change on the supply side.
So yes, after the financial crisis, the oil price was about $100 a barrel, which was very, very high by historical levels. So again, a lot of demand from industrializing countries like China. At $100, most oil producers are making pretty good money. But what really changed in that period was the shale oil revolution. So in the United States, oil production had been falling actually for decades. So the US had become a big net oil importer. This is, you know, why it was so interested in the Middle East, you know, thinking about that sort of geopolitical angle. But then around the start of the last decade, oil companies in the United States effectively invented this new method to get oil out of rocks that were previously regarded as uneconomic. And don't want to go into a sort of geology lesson here, but they're called shale rocks. They're found in spades in places like Texas, New Mexico. There's one in particular called the Permian Basin. And shale rocks are effectively like siltstone, almost like sort of clay or mud, very, very tight rock. And it became possible to extract oil that was sort of in that rock by fracturing it. So this is called fracking. So you would put down an oil well down into the ground, combine water, chemicals, sand at very high pressure, and basically blast the rock open. And that fracturing process would allow the oil to flow and be collected. And because of this, American oil production for the first time in decades started to increase by several million barrels a day. So really a material amount in the context of the overall world oil market.
Yeah, I mean, some numbers there to put that in context. As you say, US oil production had peaked in the very early 1970s at 9 or 10 million barrels a day. Mm-hmm. But as those conventional oil wells were exhausted, I think by the time of the financial crisis, the US was down to about 6 million barrels of day and had become, as you say, a net oil importer.
Yeah.
But this new technology really changed everything. It changed the game and led to a really big increase in capacity, a really big increase in supply of oil. And I guess we're leading the witness here. But what happens with this huge increase in supply? What happens to oil prices as all of this extra capacity comes online?
So it's exactly the same process, exactly the same trend. Production goes up, floods the market. As supply goes up, prices come down. And the oil price collapsed from about $100 to $50. At $50, a lot of these shale producers were not economic. Over 100 shale producers went bankrupt. They just kept on drilling, kept on oversupplying the market, and eventually the seeds of their own destruction were sown. I mean, we got some figures here from one company that survived, actually. It's a company that's still flourishing today. It's called EOG. But in 2010, their profits were $500 million. On the back of the shale revolution, they'd increased to $4.5 billion by 2014.
So a really big increase in a very short period of time.
A huge increase.
By this shale
oil boom. A huge boom. But then by 2016, they actually recorded a $6 billion loss.
So the decline in prices led to a drop in profitability. In their case, significant profit, significant losses.
Yep.
Lots of other people exit the industry. Industry supply gets curtailed. And I guess one of the things that's very interesting about shale oil is that these oil wells that are being drilled have very short effective lives. They only operate for 12 to 24 months.
Yep.
This isn't like an offshore deep water drilling project where it lasts 20 or 30
exactly.
years.
Yeah.
So this capacity can exit the market very quickly when the oil price drops.
Yes.
So these firms, can respond very nimbly really to changes in the oil price.
Yes.
And it's, a good example of that ability of, capacity and capital to exit an industry when prices are uneconomic.
Yes. And I think we can show a chart showing what's called the rig count. So this is the number of drilling rigs in the United States, and it just shows how far they fell when the crash eventually happened. And as you say, they're very short-lived wells, so the supply can come out very, very quickly. And of course, when that happens, prices recover and then normalize.
Those are two good examples from the past: iron ore, shale oil. What's the relevance of those to the AI investment boom, do you think?
Well, I think the parallels to anyone who's sort of studied these economic cycles are really, really stark. And we tend to think because it's technology, because it's AI, it's very, very complex. But we think that this has all the hallmarks of a classic capital cycle. So really, what's driving this boom today? So at the moment, there are shortages of computing capacity. So AI companies like Anthropic, OpenAI, even at Google with their Gemini product, are reporting that there are shortages of capacity, which is created by strong levels of demand and is leading to today some very high prices for effectively computing power. And the issue is that this computing power itself, this provision of computing power, appears to us to be pretty commodity-like and, you know, more akin to heavy industry than something you would expect to see in the technology sector. So we have numerous companies. We have Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Meta, which owns Instagram and Facebook, SpaceX, Oracle, newcomers like CoreWeave, Nebius, all building data centers, which basically provide computing power to AI companies like OpenAI and Anthropic. And the numbers being spent are absolutely astronomical.
Yeah, and the capacity that they're building is largely undifferentiated, would you say? You know, is a data center from Amazon different for a data center built by CoreWeave? If you're Anthropic or OpenAI, do you have a preference, or do you think these are commodity products?
I think there are slight differences in the semiconductors that they use, for example. But ultimately, I think this is a commodity product. I think that the buyer can switch between provider relatively easy. It seems like the level of differentiation is low. So our thinking is that this has all the hallmarks of being a commodity product. You know, it's AI compute power, but effectively it's no different from iron ore.
But there's, as you say, there is a huge investment boom going on here. Current level of profitability is very good, and that is drawing in more and more investment and more spending.
Yes.
So if we go back a few years, maybe about 2020 or so, the amount being spent on AI data centers would have been less than $50 billion a year.
A mere $50
billion. Just from pocket change.
Yes.
By last year, so by 2025, that had increased to $400 billion, which is an enormous amount of money.
Yep.
But if we look at forecasts from various investment banks, they expect that number to increase to $1.4 trillion by 2028. So even having had this huge run to hundreds of billions of dollars a year, they still expect the amount of spending to triple or more in just the next couple of years. And as you say, this investment, what they're spending the money on, is fairly commoditized. Everyone's buying processors, everyone's buying memory, everyone's buying power. There's fairly low differentiation between the providers here. And perhaps this sets up this is creating the seeds of the next cycle, as a huge increase in capacity might lead to oversupply in due course.
Exactly. And once again, I think everyone's focusing on demand. Everyone's focusing on demand growth and they're ignoring supply. And, you know, as we know from these previous cycles, it's supply that's as equally important as demand. So to us, it has all the hallmarks of a classic boom. And we know from history that quite often these booms are followed by busts. This would imply that at some point, all this capital spending will be cut. And of course, that would have sort of devastating consequences for many of these companies, the picks and shovels players that are supplying semiconductors to companies like Amazon, Microsoft, etc., the ones who are spending today literally hundreds of billions of dollars.
So, Julian, if we come back to the central question, you know, what do you think history does teach us about today's AI boom?
My view, is that there are many similarities with previous capital cycles, that we need to watch supply as much as demand, that the amount being built today and the amount being spent today does risk oversupply, that the economics on some of these investments may be very poor, and therefore at some point it may happen that companies start to cut back on their spending, and with it the boom turns to bust.
Yeah. And that's a feature of commodity markets, ultimately, that supply responds to levels of prices in ways that ultimately undermine the high profits that the industry has been making. So I think that's a really good observation and a good point to end the discussion. So yep. Thank you, Julian.
Good chat. Thanks, James. And thank you for watching and listening to Connected Investor. If you enjoyed this episode, do follow or subscribe. And we will see you next time. Thank you.